Bon. So it's 6 past 3 here in France. So maybe I'm going to start to introduce this new round of seminars. So I'm very happy to welcome everybody here for this very brand new round of seminars. This round of seminars is organized by the International Associated Laboratory Forestia. Forestia is an international associated laboratory between three institutions, INTA in Argentina, with different laboratories involved, INRAE in France, also with several laboratories involved, and since just a few weeks, the University of Huanta in Peru. So this International Associated Laboratory is led by Alejandro Martinez Mayer at INTA Bariloche and by myself at INRAE Orléans in France. Following an idea proposed by a colleague here at Orléans, Luc Pack, we decided to try to organize this round of new seminars with very simple seminars, with only one presentation by seminar. The main idea is to have one seminar every 4 weeks on Friday afternoon in Europe and morning in Latin America. So that's 8 a.m. in Peru, 10 a.m. in Argentina, and 3 p.m. in France. And to have this as long as we have people volunteering to present their work. So the possibility to present this seminar is first offered to the Forestia participants, but we think to open it to more people, to people from collaborating laboratories in the future. So you have on the screen the first list of seminars scheduled from now to the end of 2021. So we have 8 presentations by 8 people, 4 people from the French part of Forestia, and 4 people from the Argentinian part of Forestia. And we are going to alternate Argentinian and French presentations. So the first presentation today is going to be made by Veronica Arana. This set of seminar is co-organized by two institutions in France, a network which is called MIDI, which is a regional network dedicated to different kind of networking activities for the laboratories of our region, and to Le Studium, which is an institution dedicated to international collaboration between the region laboratories and laboratories from other parts of the world. So it's a very short introduction of these two institutions today, but in the future, we plan to make to give you more information about these institutions. So now I'm going to ask everybody to close their cameras and close their microphone if possible. And I'm going to present Veronica and to give the floor to her. The presentation is going to be about 45 minutes long, and then it's going to be followed by a question set. You will have the opportunity to ask some questions to Veronica. You can ask the question using the chat, and then we will give you the possibility to ask your question directly. First, a very fast presentation of Maria Veronica Arana. So Maria Veronica studied her license in biological sciences at the University of Buenos Aires in Argentina. And then she did a PhD in the same university under the direction of Dr. Rodolfo Sanchez, who is one of the men who described the story of the phytochromes. Her main PhD topic was the study of the light-mediated development of seed germination and seedling growth of Arabidopsis thaliana and Datura ferox. Then, Veronica moved for a first postdoc in population genetics of an endemic conifer of Patagonia, Austrocedrus chilensis. This postdoc took place at INTA EEA Bariloche in Argentina. There she worked also, she had a chance to work also at the University of Florence in Italy with Dr. Giovanni Vendramin. After this first postdoc, she moved to Valencia, Spain, to the IBMCP at the University, at the Polytechnic University of Valencia, to work also as a postdoc in Miguel Blaquez's laboratory. And there she studied the molecular basis of seedling growth with a focus on the circadian oscillation of gibberellin signaling in Arabidopsis. Now, today, she is an independent researcher of CONICET at IFAB INTA EEA Bariloche in Patagonia, Argentina. And her current work line is dedicated to the study of tree response to environment with a focus on notophagous species. And during this last period, she also works on the response of Arabidopsis thaliana to environment, and especially on the phototropic response to inflorescence stems. So I'm going to stop sharing my screen now. So Veronica, you can share your own screen and you can start your presentation.
Okay. I can turn on the camera, I think.
Yes, please. Okay.
Let me see, this is why I wanted to try before, just.
Yes.
Oof, the PowerPoint, here it is.
Okay, so it works.
Just let me see, it works. I will change
this, yes, stuff here. Yes, perfect, yes, it's on full screen.
Oh, I did it.
Very good, thank you.
Thank you very much to everybody for being here. For me, it's a pleasure to open this round of seminars. And today I will speak about responses of notophagous species to the environment. And Philippe asked me to prepare a very, very simple presentation. I know that there are people from many disciplines here. So I would like that everybody can follow the data. So I choose some examples in a very simple way in order to try and explain what we are doing. And well, we know that the global warming is a very important problem for our planet. And here, what we can see is the velocity of temperature change across the Earth's surface. This is a paper in Nature, a bit old, but I like it because it shows this velocity with this index that is in kilometers per year. So this is the velocity along the Earth's surface needed to maintain a constant temperature. And you can see that this will not be a constant for the planet, but we have places in which we have lower or faster velocities. So the changes in temperature would be different across the Earth's surface. And this has a bit to do with topography, because for example, mountains have a greater spatial gradient of temperature change compared to flat areas. We can see here the mountain, the flat areas. So modest displacement in space result in a large change in temperature. And relatively small velocities are needed to keep pace with the rate of temperature change in mountains. However, when you reach the top or the tree line, when the rock is here, you cannot move upwards. So mountains are considered ecosystems with nowhere to go, and are considered more threatened than flatter zones, for example, in this climatic scenario. And just to have a look, this is these are the predictions for our region, Patagonia, which, of course, unfortunately, they are not good. This is the predicted changes of for temperature in this period that will be in about 1 degree. And for this other period, we will have a 1.5 degrees of increment in the temperature. And this becomes worse in this climatic scenario, not so much for this period, but for this one, in which the temperature is predicted to increase in 3 degrees. And not only the temperature will increase, but it is predicted that the frequency in extreme climatic events will also increase. This means that, for example, heat waves will be more frequent in the region. So with this landscape, our main question is, which is the impact of changes in temperature in the physiology of forestry species? Because if these impacts are big at the end, they could have effect in the abundance and distribution of the species. So this is a very big question, you know. So I returned from Spain, and I was a molecular biologist, and I saw the field, and we say, well, how can we start with this? And we are working in this question using notofagous forests. These are very beautiful forests. The Notofagus genus has its ancestor in the Cretaceous, in the Antarctica, and it's spread across Gondwana, supercontinent. So we can find species of this genus both in South America and in Oceania. And here in South America, the species are distributed across Patagonia, of Chile and Argentina. And we have several endemic species that are very interesting because they are located in different ecological niches. We have both evergreen and deciduous species. So it's a very nice experimental system. And how do we study these responses? Well, basically we have a lab, our main lab, that is an elevational gradient. So we were here, we have here South America, we have in the north of Patagonia, in the Laca Lake Basin, into the Lanín National Park. I highly recommend that you must visit this park because it's just beautiful. And in this basin, we have these three species that are distributed across the altitude. What does it mean? That in the lowest zones, we have a high abundance of this one that is problem. It overlaps a bit. There is a bit of overlap between species in the limit of their distribution. But if you go upward, you can see here that we find a Rauli that is about the 1,000 meters above the sea level, and then we can find Lenga in the higher altitudes. The Lenga is a very interesting species because here in Patagonia Norte, we can find it above the 1,000 meters, but in the south, in the highest latitude of its distribution, for example, in Tierra del Fuego at 56 degrees of latitude, it is both at the sea level and in the all and across the all elevational range. So our main we thought that this could indicate that the species is in some extent sensitive to warm temperatures. So we have this system, And we have a permanent plot here for genetic and ecological studies. I cannot see very much this because I have my face, but here we have these plots. And we have one at 680 meters above the sea level in the region where probably is more frequent. Then we have another one here at 930 meters and one here where the Rauli and the Lenga are more frequent. And what we have is a meteorological station in which we are collecting data of air temperature and air humidity. We have data every hour for at least, I think, 10 years from now. And also we are collecting data of soil temperature and soil humidity. And this database is not of 10 years, but we have a huge data. And if we make an association between all these factors and the elevation, we can see that the factor that is strongly associated with the elevation gradient is the temperature. For example, here, the extreme example, we can see the daily mean temperature at 680 meters against the highest plot. And these points are, each one is one day, you know, is the daily mean temperature. And this is these are data of 3 years. So you can clearly see that the lowest plot is warmer than the highest. And we can see also this when we compare this one against this one here. And when we compare the middle, this one against the highest, so the middle and the higher parts of the gradient, we see the tendency for the highest temperature. So these differences are explicit during summer. So we can say that there are a lot of environmental variation here, but we can say that we are working in a temperature gradient. So we study the responses of these species here, and we combine these studies with experiments in the laboratory, where in the laboratory we can study the particular relevance of each factor to the behavior of the species, because we can control the environment. So basically, we use this system, our attitudinal gradient, in this way. We use reciprocal transplantations. What does mean? What does it mean? We simply move the species to the lowest or the highest plots. So we work with the species. If this is the natural distribution, we work with the species inside and outside the natural range. So we have the climatic data, we have this temperature gradient, and we have the three species, and we move them. And basically, we use this system to identify, for example, adaptive traits through the study of their contribution to the survival of the plants. We also explore the functional the functions of these traits and how they contribute to the fitness. And we also explore the genetic, the phenotypic, and the environmental variation of these traits across the gradient. So just to mention, for example, we use this to performance regeneration dynamic studies with the three species. For example, we have a plant and we do phenotyping across inside and outside the distribution range. And then in the lab, we genotype the plants and we perform association mappings. And we want to link relevant plant traits with genomic tones that can explain part of this variation. And identify, so SNPs, for example, linked to these responses. And also, and this is the part that I like the most, we take samples in the the field, and we do analysis in the laboratory. For example, we do biochemical analysis or analysis related with molecular biology. For example, we measure gene expression of the plants that are growing in the field. So this is quite an interesting system. And I want to tell that the story that I will tell you in this seminar, the chronology of this story has nothing to do with the chronology of the experiments. When we started, we had a lot of questions. So we started working with different levels, developmental levels, and with several things in the lab and in the field. And we had a lot of unexpected results, particularly from field experiments. And now, from my experience, I can say that the unexpected results were the most interesting ones. So I want to mention that also this that I will show involves the work of a lot of people. For example, here, Alejandro, who installed the plots while I was in my postdoc in Valencia. And when I returned, he invited me to work here. And he basically said, what do you need? Where must we go? So we are working together since 10 years ago. I want to mention the students that are the real stars of this story from my point of view. I will tell a bit about Max's PhD thesis, Juli's PhD thesis, and also a bit of Max's postdoc here. I want to mention Nicolás Velora, who is my bioinformatics colleague and my close friend by now. And we are studying this system from a complementary point of view, he from the bioinformatics, and I am looking everything from the molecular biology and ecophysiological part. So we are having a lot of fun. And Veronica Lía, who is the co-director of Juli, unfortunately, this system has the input of a lot of people that are interacting through a very vibrant collaboration. So this work involves the effort of many of us. So the first story, this is quite an old story. You can find it here. So I will go very fast across here, but I want to mention this because these results were like the beginning of a lot of questions, you know? So the first thing that we did was to study the phenology of germination across altitude. And basically what we did was to put germination bags here, the seeds of the three species. So we have seeds of the species into and outside the natural range. And just what we did was to go here in these different moments of the year. Ale probably will remember this in midwinter because it is very, very difficult to go upward because we can have about one meter or 1.5 meters of snow. We must search the seeds there. So what we did was to score the germination across elevation and in these different periods. And in the lab, what we did was to build thermal time models in order to describe these phenological changes in relation to the temperature. And I want to recommend the threshold models in general for studying the responses of species to the environment because they are very nice and very robust too. And the first thing that I would like to show you is that the models could very, very nicely predict the behaviors of the seeds in the field. You can see here the models in the white bars and the behaviors of the seeds in the field in the black bars. So we can say here that the phenology of germination along the altitudinal gradient is mainly controlled by the temperature. And look at this. This was one of the results that we didn't understand at the beginning. when the this is example just with Roble and Lenga, with these species are in the natural range, for example, the Roble here in the warmer zones and Lenga here in the colder zones, you can see that the big proportion of the population of the seeds are able to germinate in early spring. We practically have no germination here, or here for Roble is everything is germinated here. So we can say that the germination is coordinated across altitude when the species are inside the natural range. However, when we move the species, for example, here, the Lenga to the warmer zones, remember that Lenga used to be here, it's not here, we can see a shift. The phenology of germination occurs about 1 month early in late winter. And when we move the Roble here to the highest plot, we can see that less than half of the proportion of the population germinates. So the germination occurs here mainly in mid-spring, so it's delayed. So we can say that when the species are in the natural range, they coordinate the germination, but when they are in different thermal environments that are not the thermal environments of their natural environment, this timing of germination is uncoupled. So the immediate question that we ask here is if that timing of germination affects survival across altitude, because survival as a component of fitness. In other words, if timing of germination is an adaptive trait for this species. So this is part of Julieta Catenacci's PhD. And to answer this question, you know, is somewhat tricky, because if we leave the seeds, for example, in autumn in the forest, as I show you, we are able to explore just as a narrow window of narrow temporal window of germination, that is the moment in which the seed germinate in the field, but we will not be able to see how is the performance of the Roble seedlings in late winter in the upper plot, because they would never germinate. So what we thought is that we could simulate germination pulses here in different moments of the year across altitude. So this was somewhat crazy at the beginning, but at the end, we like it very much this design. We germinated seeds in the lab. Here you can see the seeds with the radicals. And we also put germination bags in the field in order to score the germination timing, the natural germination timing of the species across the gradient. And we put these seeds along the elevation in these different moments of the year. And you can see here, for example, this huge environmental variability across altitude for late winter. I used to call this the tunnel of time, you know, because you are working here and the next day you go there and it's winter. Plants have no leaves, nothing. So it's amazing. And you have also this variation along time. So we use this system in order to answer our question. So here we have the different germination events that we generated along these moments. And we put the seeds here, we cover them with soil, and the next month we see this. And the first time it was a big surprise to see that it worked. So we used two to three replicates per altitude and date of sowing on species. We used 100 or 200 germinated seeds per replicate, and we did 3 years of experiments. So we have 3 biological replicates. And we see that, so we worked with about 4,800 germinated seeds per year, that this means that we scored the emergence and survival of 14,400 terminated seats. And I put these numbers in different color because when I moved from indoor experiments to outdoor experiments, we found that there was a huge variability in the responses of the organisms to the environment, and particularly in these early stages. So this number allowed us to see what was happening with a reasonable statistic power, you know? So here we can see the graph of seedling survival across altitude for the three species and the different moments of sowing. And this is the data of the 3 years of experiments. And we analyzed this with generalized linear mixed models. We are having the help of Regina Cavia, who is becoming my hero in statistics, because this is a huge database. And so we choose a generalized linear mixed model with fixed factors that are altitude, species, and time of sowing. And as random factors, we use year and replicate. And we had a significant triple interaction. From the opinion of Regina, this is not common for ecology. So we have a lot of data, and we can see with statistical power that we have differences in the behavior of species that is both influenced by altitude and time and the time of sowing. And something amazing that we saw is that in our models, we could see that the year at the end had no significant effect. So we could see the results taking away the annual environmental variability because we have a lot of data. And this makes me very happy because this makes me feel quite sure about what I am telling to you. And so if you see here, and you remember the pattern of germination across altitude, the natural pattern of germination across altitude, just with these two examples, Roble and Lenga, and you see the proportion of seedling survival, you can notice, for example, that for Lenga in the lowest plot, the moment of highest survival is here, that is late winter, that is the same moment in which the seeds germinate in the warmer plot. You can see here, for example, that there is no germination, but germination happens in early spring in the in its natural area. And we have here the most proportion of survival for this species. So we can say in some extent that the Lenga is able to coordinate its germination timing to the best or to the favorable temporal window or climatic window for the survival of the seedlings. But if you remember here, the Roble, the biggest proportion of the population germinated here in mid-spring, and it is clearly not the best moment for the survival of the seedlings. So we have these two species distributed in the elevation, and we see what is happening when we move them here. We can see that the Lenga can coordinate the phenology of germination to the favorable climatic window for the survival of the seedlings, but this is not the case for the Roble. So we think that in some extent, this phenomena is influencing in the capacity of growth of the species in the highest altitudes. In fact, we don't find the species there. And this can be one of the factors that is contributing to this distribution. So the next question that we did is if there are interspecific differences in the responses of young seedlings to the environment. And something that I didn't tell is that we didn't measure seedling survival just at the end of the first growth season, but we went many times to the forest. you know. And what we did was to sound this, the terminated seeds, but we scored survival here, 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 here. So every 1 month. And if you remember here, our experimental design, now we did all this survival counting for this period. So we can say that we have a database with 21,600 counting events. It's a huge database, and Huli is doing a very nice work managing the database and analyzing the results. So with this database, for example, we are doing a lot of things, of course, we have it. But here I showed you that we could model the survival probability of the seedlings in different stages through Kaplan-Meier curves. And here we can see the survival probability when we put the seeds here in late winter, early spring, mid-spring, mid-spring. And we can see here the environmental variation. We can see also how the survival probability decays. And we can see here, for example, the differences between altitudes. And you can see that these bars are sometimes thinner or have different size. And these are the standard errors. So with this amount of data, we can see differences, significant differences in these patterns, you know, because we cannot see that these error bars are shown here. So what we can see with this, for example, is we did this not just for the first growth season. We have the data for the second growth season, so the second year, and for some years, the third year. So through this, we can identify the moment of stronger susceptibility of the seedling to the environment where we have highest mortality. And we could see, for example, for roble, that it was around the 60 days after germination. And so we have this transition in all these numerous environmental scenarios. And this is very nice because now we can model the effect of this climatic environment in these processes that are very susceptible to the environment. And we cannot travel to the future in order to see how the seedlings will respond to the new climate, but what we can do is to see in the present how they are working in these different climatic scenarios that in some extent they could have some similarities with the future, you know? So I see that this is a very interesting experiment. And we have this for the three species. I am showing just two because of, just for the sake of the presentation, you know, of simplicity of the presentation. And we can see here the roble and the lenga. And so now we are not only able to see interspecific responses, but also interspecific responses. So we can see the differences in behavior of these two species across the different environments. We are analyzing the data and we are trying to find the environmental factors that are contributing to the behaviors of the seedlings. And we are trying to modeling this in order just not to describe, but also to predict. And what happens next? Because we saw that, for example, lenga is very able to fit the germination timing to the moment of the best survival, for example. So what happened next? What happened why, for example, lenga is not here? There are a lot of reasons, but we wanted to see what happens with plants, with plants a bit later in the development here and here. And for this, we did a reciprocal transplantation study where we have both species. Now we are we took plants that are 1 year old, and we installed the experiment in 2017. So these plants are now 5 years old. They are in the forest, in these altitudes, both species. We have a block design with about 400 of plants here in the experiment, distributed in the altitude and in the blocks. We have the environmental variability here scored. And here we can see the plants. And this was very early after the first year in the field. Now they are bigger. And you can see here the huge environmental variability, because these pictures were taken in the same day, but you can see here the plot, the highest plot and the lowest plot in autumn. So we have the plants growing, and what we do is phenotyping, and we are taking the data of leaf area, specific leaf area, stomatal density, photosynthetic pigment, near infrared spectroscopy, chlorophyll, fluorescence, algal growth, and survival. And we are planning to analyze even more traits, but at least we have these ones. And I will show just a brief example with just a few of these traits. This is a principal component analysis. And here we can see the species distributed, this configuration of distribution of the species according to phenotypes. And we can see, for example, that both species show similar behaviors in the field experiments. For example, in Bosch species, we could see that photosynthetic pigments were positively correlated and had a very strong contribution to this axis of the PCA. And we can see here that chlorophyll, fluorescence, and growth are positively correlated too, with the highest contribution to this other axis. And this configuration is biologically logic, because we can say that it's logic that plants with more stresses, that we can see here for this parameter, have a less growth and less accumulation of pigment. So the experiment is working accordingly to what we would expect. And when we try to see the behavior of these traits in each species across altitude through this redundancy analysis, we can see that the altitude had no effect in the phenological, in the phenotypic differences among roble plants, but had a significant effect in the phenotypic variation observed in Lenga. So here we can see again a different behavior between species, in which the plants of Lenga show different performances when they are inside or outside the natural range. And we see that when they are in the natural range, they grow more, they are more less stressed, and they have more pigment. So we can see here that this is current. And what we are doing, I will not show results now because they are preliminary, but we have a very, very nice sequencing data. We are performing DD RAT-seq in all these individuals, and we are we will make association mapping in order to link physiological traits to region of these genomes that would be involved in this response. We are doing this in collaboration with Hua Wang and Detlef Weigel, that they work in Germany. So if we return to this graph, we can say that we saw some problems for roble here in the first stage when they plant, the individuals are outside the range. And we can see that Lenga is experiencing some problems here. So the next thing that we ask is if there are interspecific differences in the response to temperature between Roble and Lenga at your plant stages, you know? And this is very interesting because if Roble can overcome these stages, it has no problems then when the plants are bigger. So we wanted to see if we can find anything that can at least give us a cue about this behavior. I think that the association mapping will be a very interesting result, but we wanted to study this also in a functional way. So in this part of the presentation, I will take you to the circadian clock, this beautiful system. I will tell you afterwards why, but we can define the circadian clock as a central oscillator that is trained by environmental signals that have predictable changes like temperature and light. And so when this clock is trained, it provides rhythms or rhythmicity to different phenotypes of the plant at different molecular levels, you know? This is part of Maxi's PhD thesis that is co-directed by Nico, and Maxi did a very, very nice work. Maxi is leaving us in a few days. He's going for a postdoc in Sweden. So what does the circadian clock? Basically, the circadian clock anticipates the responses of the organism to predicted changes in the environment that can be daily or seasonally. And just this is to show that the circadian clock comprises different complex transcriptional loops. There are some components that are also regulated at the protein level. And these genes, many of them, have a very particular pattern of expression. If we see here the expression against a time, we can see that the expression of these clock genes, for example, TOP1 and LHY, is a cyclic. This is a very, very nice, I love this paper, it's in Chestnut. And we can see here, for example, that TOP1 has a maximum peak of expression at dusk and LH at dusk and LHY at dawn, you know, in morning. And why we are interested in the circadian clock? Because we know that it's a master regulator of growth and development. And we know that the coordination of the notion of rhythms with the periodicity of changes in the environment promotes the fitness of the individual. This is a very nice paper also by Dodd in Science. And this is very interesting for us. We know that the circadian clock can couple the endogenous rhythms with the environment in a range of temperature. Out of this range, the circadian clock is not able to couple the rhythms. So, it is proposed that the ranges of temperature are particular for each species. So knowing that the circadian clock, the coordination of the rhythms with the changes in the environment promotes fitness, we can think that the ranges in which the clock can work properly may contribute to the range of temperature in which the species could survive. This is a huge hypothesis, so I will try and give some evidence that can say yes or no about this. But I think that we have a lot of work here. So when we started working with this, of course, we didn't know anything about temperature responses in Nothofagus. We didn't know anything about circadian clock, and we didn't know anything about genes, you know? We had no gene sequences for these species. So we had the fortune to make a sequencing, RNA sequencing at the middle of Maxi's PhD thesis. that could provide us with a pattern of expression and gene sequences. And we made this RNA-seq in Lenga leaves growing chambers, and the choice of the protocol for this experiment was a bit tricky. I spoke a lot with Marcelo Janowski, with an Argentinian guy that knows a lot about circadian clock. And at the end, I decided to follow the circadian protocols. And I used this protocol, in which this is typical of circadian clock experiments, in which we train with light and dark cycles the plants here at 20 degrees. And then we leave the chamber in continuous light, so in free running conditions. In Arabidopsis, it is described that the clock, when it's trained here, and the stimulus is not anymore, so the environment is in free running conditions. For example, the clock genes continue oscillating here. But for example, this is not true for conifers and other trees or other species. But well, we choose this protocol, and we choose 20 degrees the control or 34 degrees as temperature treatment. And this was also difficult, because which temperature should we use? We could do just few RNA-seq analysis, so we wanted to be sure that we were going to capture any differences, and we choose a temperature that is not so frequent in the highest block. So we choose this one, and we sample leaves in this and this moment, so at the third day in the subjective dawn and dusk. And this means the moment in which the lights would turn on and off if the lights would be in a photoperiodic protocol. So we had two temperatures, two moments of the day, and two biological replicates per treatment. So we made a de novo assembly of the transcriptome. This was very hard. This made that Maxi had to study a lot of programmation in C and Python and everything. Fortunately, Nico is here, and he guided this part. And we could isolate 19 or identify 19 sequences with high homology to clock genes of other species. We could prove some of these relation with phylogenetic trees. And for example, here we can see the expression of TOP1 and LHY in these conditions that I told, so in free running conditions at 20 degrees. We can see that one has the typical peak of expression at dusk and LHY in the morning. And this was also the case for Robles. So this is indicating that these genes would be working as circadian clock genes. And what happens when we analyze the expression of these genes, not at 20, but at 34 degrees? We can see that these peaks in Lenga are lost. So this is indicating or suggesting that 34 degrees is into the thermal range in which the circadian clock functions are disrupted in Lenga. We made a transcriptomic analysis, and I don't want to tell a lot about this now. I will tell you afterwards why. But we saw a big rearrangement of the transcriptome. We choose, for example, we made a differential expression analysis in which we choose the genes that had any change the expression between this point and this point at 20 degrees, and that the high temperatures changed the pattern of this expression. We could find growth, photosynthesis, carbon assimilation, and heat stress related genes, for example. So it seems that this regulation by temperature is having some impact in these processes that are the ones that we saw that are affected in some extent in the field. But this protocol that I showed is quite artificial, you know. At the end, we want to study the responses of the trees to the environment and what we are doing in free running conditions. So the next stage was to analyze the expression of these genes in diurnal conditions and also at different temperatures. For example, here we can see the expression of TOC1 in dengue. And we can see that there are not very strong differences. We don't see difference here between 20 and 28 degrees. So I will show just the results that we have at 20. And when we try this at 31 degrees, we can see that this pattern of oscillation is somewhat lost. So this peak is like narrow here. Now it's just happening 3 hours after the lights are on in the chambers, and at 34 degrees, this is absolutely lost, you know. And here, this is another example. I choose just a few examples to make this presentation very simple. We have here Gigantea, and we can see here that it has a maximum peak of expression at 9, and this peak is lost here at 31 degrees. And we didn't see expression of Gigantea across the different biological replicates. This is point. So we can say here that 31 degrees is disrupting the oscillation of this circadian clock. What happens with Roble? This is a fantastic and a very nice experiment, you know, because we can see here again the peak of expression. This species at 20 degrees that is happening at 9 or 6 hours after the lights turn on. And we can see here at 31 degrees that the peaks are pretty conserved, you know? This means that 31 degrees is not affecting the oscillation of the genes in Roble. And if you remember, the Roble is the species that is in the warmer environment. And then if we see this at 34 degrees, well, we can see here quite a mess, but some genes still are keeping their phase, you know? The important things here that you must see is that 31 degree can affect the oscillation of these genes in Lenga, the species that is in the colder environment, but not in Roble, the species that is in the warmer environment. So this higher limit of temperature for this oscillation of the genes are in some extent associated with the preferred thermal niches of the species. So while this happened in the lab, and the question is this relevant in the forest? What is happening? So we did this experiment. We went to the elevational gradient. So we have this climatic data. We have these 9 difference in temperature between altitudes that we can see that other factors are not associated with the altitude. And we did reciprocal transplantations again. So putting the Roble and the Lenga inside and outside the range, you can see it here. And this experiment was very, very funny because we went with tents, lots of food, and liters of liquid nitrogens. And we sampled the seedlings for 2 days every 3 hours. This was fantastic. And then here you can see the oscillation in the maximum temperature. And you can see that the environment is pretty more warmer here than here in the highest altitude. So we took the seedlings to the lab, we did RNA extractions. So we sampled it here and we studied the expression of clock genes. And we also analyzed plant traits, these traits I will show you now, to see the performance of the seedlings and to see if we could associate in some extent the performance of the seedling with the expression of these clock genes along elevation. And we have here the example for 3 genes for Lenga, TOC1, LHY, and Gigantea. Here we can see the level of expression, and here we can see the time. sorry, I don't know what happens here, it's not the axis. And we can see that the genes have a very remarkable oscillation in the expression in the field. But if you see, for example, here, and we compare the maximums between the lowest and the highest plot, we can see that out of the distribution range, there is a delay in 3 hours in the maximum peak of top one. But what happens? When we see LHY, we can see, if we compare the highest with the lower plot, that now the peak of LHY is 3 hours earlier. And here, the peak in Xi'an-Tea does not change. So when we saw this, I felt a bit puzzled about this result, Maxi, of course, too. And I had the possibility to speak to a very relevant people in the circadian clock field in plants, for example, Robert McClure or Alex Webb or Andy Miller from Misadventure to speak to all of them and show these results. And I said, well, look at this, what happens here? Because the genes are not changing all in the same phase when you move along altitudes. And they said, well, but you can see that the maximum peaks are not similar between elevation. You cannot expect that all the changes are shifting in the same way in the between altitudes, you know. What this result means is that the maximum peaks and the expression of these genes is different when you compare the elevation, and that this could mean that the circadian clock function would, in some extent, be influenced by the environment. So I was a bit more quiet with the result. And so we can see here the plant traits, and we can see that all these traits, the chlorophyll contents or the dry weight or the seedling survival, reduced out of the distribution range. So we have some sort of association between this pattern of oscillation and the plant rates for Pumilio Denga. What happens with Roble? Well, here I will show you 2 genes. I will tell you afterwards why, but we have also data with LHY that we are analyzing. We must try other genes. I must confess that these are the only results that we have here, and I will tell you why. And here, what we can say is the expression of top one and Xi'an-Tea, and we can see that Xi'an-Tea has the same the temporal maximum of expression here between altitudes, and we can see these similar results for top one, the first day. And the second day, we could not see the result. But what happened here is that the maximum peak in the natural distribution area was somewhat delayed, because the difference here is in 28 hours. And normally we see the peaks, the maximum peaks that are happening every 24 hours in all the experiments. So this is a bit tricky. But we can say that we cannot see so clearly the differences in the expression pattern between altitude as we can see in Lenga. And we didn't find an association between the plant rates and these patterns, or differences between plant rates and the elevation. So we are working with these evidences that says that the upper temperature limit for coral clock function in Lenga and Roble in some extent relates to the thermal characteristic of their preferred ecological niche. These are the lab experiments, and that in Lenga there is an oscillation. Sorry, I made something wrong here. But what I want to say is that there is a correlation or an association, yes, an association, it says, between the upper temperature limit and the performance of the circadian clock function and the performance of the seedlings across the different thermal environments. And we are working with these models that propose that in, for example, for Lenga, in cool environments, the circadian clock can couple the endogenous rhythms with environment. We are doing more experiments in order to prove this at other levels. For example, expression of genes that are under clock control. We can analyze the expression of these genes in these two altitudes. And when the Lenga is in the warm environment, this function is disrupted, and this is associated with the performance of the cilia. And this is not the case for Broadway. So we have all this data. We are seeing, for example, evidences that we can, we are having, there are alternative explaining events, for example, in the species. But when we want to be sure, and we would like to study more accurately the adaptation of the species to the environment. So what do we urgently need? I could say that we need not a whole genome is the immediate answer. Because they will allow us, for example, to study epigenetics responses to the environment. We will be able to study also some evolutionary relationships that are not clear for the genus. We will be able to study alternative splicing, transcriptional regulations, other stuff, and phenotypic variation, the genotypic variation of the species across the range. And of course, for the association mapping that we are doing, it's better to have a reference genome, you know, because you can associate this name to maybe some gene or regulatory region. So we are doing that at this moment. This is wonderful. At the beginning, it was a dream. And we are doing this in collaboration with Rodrigo Gutierrez in Chile, because we share the species and we share the interest and we share the everything. So what we are doing is we are doing a combined strategy of sequencing using Illumina reads, different pyridine and mate pair libraries of different lengths. And we combine these reads with nanopore sequencing for getting long reads to improve the scaffolding. And we have a nuclear genome assembly at this moment of a total length of 385 kilobases, more or less half of the genome. We have this parameter here. And we see that this assembly has a strong completeness. I mean, there is it has a high representative representativeness in terms of genes, because we tested the amount of Busco genes here. This is a database of eudicotyledon genes, and that is used to see the representativity of the genome in terms of amount of genes. And we can see that we have about 86% of the Busco genes in our assembly. We could also see that about 90% of the reads of the experiments that I showed you before had a unique mapping seeds in our genome assembly. And this is indicating or suggesting that we were able to correctly assemble virtually the all the coding and high complexity regions of the genome, or the most or the majority of this region. And we could assemble the chloroplast. Well, the boys, Maxi and Nico, made a very nice job. We have here the chloroplast of Lenga, that it has a length of 166 kilobases. And we could see that the chloroplast structure is conserved among species of plants. We are doing some phylogenetical studies here that are very interesting. And we annotated for ribosomal RNAs, 27 transfer RNAs, and 82 coding codifying proteins. And we have here the mitochondria of a length of 354 kilobases. And in this case, we saw that the structure is not conserved between other plant species. So for the boys, this was a bit difficult, a more difficult job, because they could not use a clear structural reference, but they succeed, you know. And we have here seven ribosomal RNAs, 24 transfer RNAs, and 40 coding proteins. So with this genome, we hope to increase or enhance our study related to adaptation and phenotypic variation, and at the end to assess more accurately the responses of these trees to the environment. So if we return to this, we can say that we could find adaptive traits related with germination and seedling survival here, and that we could see if there is specific differences in the performance of the plant traits across the elevation between these two species, that the species have a different bottlenecks for support for the growth out of the distribution areas. At least it seems that early developmental stages are in some extent not favored for Roble in the highest plot, and the performance of seedlings or plants are not favored for Lenga here in the warmer plots. And something that I want to know is that we are learning to use the environmental spatial variation in combination with the temporal spatial variation in this gradient to study the responses of these trees to the environment. And we see that it's very important to combine these studies with laboratory experiments in order to achieve an integral response to our question. So what we can say is that we are using multiple approaches. So our work involves multidisciplinary approach. And so through threshold models, we can prediction the phenological transitions and the different environments. We are doing this also for seedlings, I didn't show that. We are studying the plant performance across the environment with ecophysiological experiments, combining ecophysiology with molecular biology and functional genomics. We are studying the functional meaning of these traits. We are linking circadian clock performance with the capacity of growth or with seedling performance here across the elevation. We are combining this genetic biochemistry and ecophysiological studies in order to make to associate genome regions with responses of the plants to the environment. And through the genomics, we are building genomes. We are having also a draft of the Roble genome through the collaboration with Weigel. So we are performing genomes, and this will increase our studies and allow us to study more accurately adaptation, evolution, and the epigenetic responses of the organisms to the environment. And if you see this picture, I know you will see what happens with these stages. We are studying in the frame of Via Forestia with the Alien Cyril Rocher. Sorry for the pronunciation, Cyril. And we are planning about other trees, and we want to measure growth, wood formation, for example, and phenology in these stages to try to see if we can find here adapted traits related to the responses of the environment. So thank you for your attention. I hope you like the talk, and this is the story that I have for you today. Thank you.